Our gracious Lord and Heavenly Father, we come before your throne this morning again. We're so happy for the rest that you have, that you gave us in the night and the new day, and we want to glorify you throughout this day. We invite you to guide our thoughts as we open the scriptures. In Christ's name, amen. Rain. If you don't like rain, you're in the wrong place. I love rain. Too much of it is a problem, you know, but it's good to have rain. Now, we're going to deal today with the reason why we have this book written the way it was written. What is the purpose of the book? But before we get into that, let me make a suggestion here for you. You know, you're probably preachers, most of you, including the ladies. And if you're not a preacher, you better become one. I mean, it's wonderful to share the message of the Bible. And you can easily develop a series of sermons on the characters in this story. You know, you can easily take Haman as a symbol of evil, the enemy. Mordecai represents the people of God. And Esther would represent whom? The church? Jesus. What would be the role of the role that she's playing as representing Jesus? What would be the role? Mediator, intercessor. So if you want to talk about Jesus as intercessor, now some people might feel uncomfortable with that, you know, because we don't want to give the impression that Jesus is a woman, but he in this story, the role of mediation and intercession is placed in the hands of Esther. And this is something that would be good to share with church members, you know, that the Lord also incorporates in his plans and represents his work of salvation through ladies, not only through men. And then you have the whole topic of the great controversy to develop there. The question is why the biblical writer inspired by God wrote a story in which there is no religious language. That is the question. Why? And in order to try to find an answer, this is what we do. Now, this is, you know, I've been telling you this week how I went about doing the study, hoping that this will help you. Perhaps it won't help you, but... And hoping that the way I did it will encourage you to fall in love with biblical narratives and study them and try to get out of them as much as you can. So the question is, how do you do this? Now, in biblical studies, when you're studying the scriptures, I told you that you have to take into consideration the immediate context. And that's what we did. We took sections, scenes, and we studied them in their context. And then we also studied them in the context of the whole book. And even we studied the story of Esther in the context of the whole scripture. The book is part of the canon, and what contribution that fact makes to a better understanding of the book. You remember that? You probably don't remember that by now. So the question is, now what next? Next is you're going to check the historical and religious context in which the book was written. And that will help us to answer the question, why the biblical writer, under divine inspiration, decided to write a book in which there is no explicit religious language. Not only that God is not mentioned, but that there is not explicit religious language in the book. Why? What was the historical context? Anybody dares to make an opinion? When was this story written? When?
Babylon fell to the Persians, and it takes place in the Persian Empire after
So it was written after 539. You know, the king, Xerxes is king, so, you know, it's 4th century B.C. That's what we call the post-exilic period. So let's deal with that. You know that Babylon came to Jerusalem and destroyed the city and took the people to Babylon, and we call that the exile. They were taken to the exile. But before the exile, there was a problem beginning to, a serious theological problem beginning to take shape within Israel, among the Israelites. And this problem grew and became a huge, very serious problem during the exilic period and the post exilic period. The post-exilic period is the period that came after 539, when the Medo-Persians said to the Israelites, you can go back to Jerusalem. You can go back to Jerusalem. And at that point begins the post-exilic period, because now they don't have to be in exile. They can go back to Jerusalem. Are we together? Or I'm confusing you. I'm very good at confusing people, so don't feel bad. They pay me to confuse them, and then they pay me to clarify the confusion, and in the problem I create more confusion. Historians and theologians have concluded that one of the key problems that the people of Israel faced a little before the exile, a little before the fall of Jerusalem, and then after the exile, was a very serious religious problem, a crisis of faith in the Lord. And you find that already before the exile. Let's read together a few passages from the prophets. Habakkuk. Now, this is among the minor prophets, you know, after Nahum, is that what we say it in English? Nahum or Nahim? Nahum? Before Zechariah, I think. Or Haggai. Listen to this. I'm trying to illustrate the point that even before the fall of Jerusalem, the people of Israel were beginning already to go through this serious theological crisis. And I'm raising this issue because it's not too different from what we're going through. Okay, and I told you Monday when we began that the book of Esther really is dealing with a problem that we are facing, the problem of the silence of God. 1, verses 2 through 4. This is the prophet. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? What was it that he was experiencing? The silence of God. Or cry out to you, and I say violence, but you do not save. Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. What is he doing? What is the prophet doing? He's complaining. And what is he complaining about? You know, what are you doing? Where are you? I'm in this city and there is a lot of crime and violence, and you're not doing anything. You don't even listen to me. And then the Lord spoke to him, and what he said to him, he didn't like it. Human nature. He said to him, okay, I hurt you, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring the Babylonians. And I'm going to destroy all these people in Jerusalem. And I'm going to destroy Jerusalem. And then the prophet said, but how can you do that? I mean, this is not a good, that's not a good idea. You're using people who are worse than us to punish us. You know, it's very difficult to please the Lord. And this is the tension that we find throughout the rest of the pre-exilic and exilic period. People were confused about God. They were not experiencing the voice of God. And they were confused. They didn't know what to do. In fact, they were doing whatever they wanted. Jeremiah chapter 12. Listen, this is what the people were saying, you know. They were in Jerusalem going through very difficult experiences. And Jeremiah is also very concerned about the situation. And he's praying to the Lord and he's saying to the Lord, how long will the land lie parched? You know, there is no rain. Things are very difficult in the land. And then at the end of the verse in Jeremiah 12:4, at the end of the verse, he quotes the people. The people are saying, he, that is to say God, will not see what happens to us. What does that mean? He will not see what happens to us. He's indifferent. Doesn't matter what happens to us, he's not involved any longer with us. So there was a feeling among the Israelites of divine abandonment. The Lord is not with us. And then came the Babylonian armies and surrounded the city. Now, the siege took 2 years. Now, can you imagine that? The armies are around the city. The city is closed. The doors, are closed. And the people are inside the city. They cannot go out to get food. Now, water they can get because, you know, there was a wave. Hezekiah built a tunnel that brought water into the city. So water was not the problem. The problem was food. And the situation got so difficult that they practiced inside the city cannibalism. Lamentation chapter 4 verse 10. No. This is a passage that is really bad that this passage is in the Bible. Lamentations 4:10. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own children, who became their food when my people were destroyed. Now, can you imagine the impact of that experience on faith? The faith of these people had simply gone, almost gone. And the ministry of Jeremiah among them was to tell them, you know, hold on to faith, you know, repent, come back to the Lord. He will, you know, don't fight the Babylonians. Open the doors and tell them to come in and the problem will be solved. This is what the Lord wants you to do. And he was accused of insurrection. Of course it was insurrection. It was discouraging people from fighting and telling the soldiers, don't fight. The Lord says, don't fight. It's amazing that he was not killed. And then came the fall of Jerusalem. The priests and the false prophets. Jeremiah on the one side saying the Lord is going to destroy the city. The false prophets and the priests telling the people that's not true. This is the city of the Lord. The temple is here. He's going to protect us and save us. So don't listen to Jeremiah. And then the city was destroyed. and the temple was destroyed. And the question was, why did this happen? Why did this happen? And this was an extremely important question, because you have to remember that in the ancient Near East, the destruction of a people meant that their God was not able to preserve them. That there was a more powerful God than their God. And the other God had defeated their God. So the question was, why was not the Lord able to save us? And this is a question that the prophets, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, what is the other prophet? Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the book of Chronicles, and the book of Kings. That question is the one that they are addressing. We call that theodicy. This is two Greek words. Theo means God, and dice comes from dike, which means justice. The prophets had to show that God was right. He was just in what he did. And that's what Jeremiah is doing. That's what Ezekiel is doing. That's what the book of Chronicles is doing, because they faced a people whose faith has collapsed. And then, now they want to help them to build up that faith, telling them, don't worry, you know, the city was destroyed, but here is the reason. And the reason is that you people were worshiping idols. That in the temple you were not worshiping the Lord, you were worshiping Baal and the sun god and the moon goddess. And you broke the covenant with the Lord. So, you know, there is a reason for this. It's not that Yahweh, the Lord, was not powerful enough to protect us. It was that you broke the covenant. And these are the covenant curses. But the people didn't listen. They didn't listen. So that the theodicy was not as good as, not as good, but was not acceptable to the people. Now, once the city fell, there were three reactions from the people. You had three group of people when the city is destroyed. A group stayed in Jerusalem. A group was taken to the exile. And a group went to Egypt. Now, let's see what happened to those groups. We're exploring the spiritual situation, the religious condition of the people of God in Jerusalem and in the exile. Let's read a couple of passages just to see the reaction of the Jews to the fall of Jerusalem. Jeremiah 44. Now, this is important for the book of Esther. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not doing this to punish you. It's just that this is indispensable in order to understand the book of Esther. 44:15 through 19. Let's read the whole thing. It will give you a clear view of the condition of the Israelites. Then all the men who knew their wives were burning incense to other gods, along with all women who were present, and all the people living in Lower and Upper Egypt, said to Jeremiah. This is the group that went to Egypt, and Jeremiah went with them. And they say to Jeremiah, "We will not listen to the message you have spoken to us in the name of the Lord." Why? "We will certainly do everything we said we would. We will burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and will pour our drink offerings to her, just as we and our fathers, our kings, and our officials did in the towns of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. At that time, we had plenty of food, and we were all off and suffered no harm." But ever since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, we have had nothing and have been perishing by sword and famine. Wow, what do you think about that? Was there a crisis of faith or what? And these people, you know, they said, you know, the Queen of Heaven was the goddess that really was good to us. Then one day we decided to worship the Lord and things went wrong. So we're going back to the Queen of Heaven. Forget about the Lord. He was defeated. Nobody was able to defeat the Queen of Heaven when we were worshiping her. Now we came to the Lord and there he was defeated. Now the people in the exile, Ezekiel 20:32. And we're going to have water. The people said to Ezekiel 20:32, "You say, we want to be like the nations, like the peoples of the world who serve wood and stone." So what the people in the exile were saying? We're going to worship idols. You have to understand again, you know, they saw the temple destroyed, the city destroyed. The conclusion, our God is a weak God. So we better go and find these other gods that are being worshipped in Babylon who were more powerful than ours. Ours didn't do anything. We didn't see him doing anything for us. So we're going and worship these idols. And of course, there was another group who accepted the message of the prophets. And they declared, Lamentations 1:18, for instance, and Jeremiah 31:24, they immediately said, "The Lord is righteous. He did to the city what he had to do. The city deserved that." So you had these three groups. But the crisis of faith was indeed very, very strong. It threatened to destroy Judaism. It threatened to destroy Judaism. So the prophets, immediately the Lord began to tell the prophets, you know, preach to the people during the exile. Tell them that this is not the end. What they did came as a result of the violation of the covenant. That was judgment. But God's word, the last word that God speaks to humans is never judgment, it's salvation. He preaches judgment, but his last word is salvation. So he said to the prophet, "Preach to them and tell them, I'm bringing you back from the exile. I'm going to give you the land." And you read Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah, and you have beautiful poetic descriptions of the new Exodus. There is going to be a new Exodus. And you remember when I brought you out of Egypt through the wilderness, I provided water for you and provided food. Now I'm going to do the same. I'm going to bring you out of Babylon back to the land that I promised to Abraham, trying to instill hope, to rekindle faith in among these people that were spiritually, practically spiritually dead. Well, the crisis, in spite of all of that, continued. And even after the exile, you find the prophets dealing with the same problem. Malachi chapter 1. See if I can find a verse. 2. Malachi, as the last book in the Old Testament. Look at this. This is the Lord talking to the people, and the Lord said to them, "I have loved you." I do love you. he says. You know, it doesn't matter what you have experienced. I do love you. But you ask, how have you loved us? And you say you love us. How? I mean, is this the way to show love to us? See, what you have here, again, is an expression of lack of confidence in the Lord. You love me and I'm going through this situation? What are you talking about? You know? What is it that you are really doing for me? You have the same thing in the book of Haggai, or Haggai, chapter 1. The people are planting, and there's no food in the fields. There's no rain. You know, they left Babylon. They went back to Jerusalem to build the temple. They began to build their houses, to plant the land. But there's no rain. There's no food. So the people are saying, well, you know, we made a mistake. We made a mistake coming here. We thought that this was the new Exodus. But it isn't. There's nothing to do here. And they said, we're not going to build the temple until we are sure that the Lord is with us. And the prophet had to come and tell them, hey, you're misreading the whole thing. You came here to build the temple and you went, took your piece of land and forgot about the temple. You have to put God first in your life. That's what you have to do. Put God first in your life. Stop complaining. This is what you have in the book of these two minor prophets. So they came to Jerusalem and the experience was not much better. They still were struggling with faith. Is God really with us? Is he really leading us? Or is he not? Return from the exile was not a miraculous event. You see, the prophets used the typology of the Exodus from Egypt in poetic language to describe the return. But in reality, the way God brought them out of Babylon was a little different. There was not a visible manifestation of power as you had in the book of Exodus, you know. The miraculous happened in the heart of the king. Let's read Ezra. Ezra is a little before Job. Verse 1. Chapter 1, verse 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord, what did he do? Moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia. Where was now the miraculous power of God working? Silently, quietly, but very effectively, in the heart of the king. The theophany, the apparition of God that you had in Exodus on Mount Zion, is not found in the experience of the new Exodus. What you find is a theophany in the heart of the king. Quiet, silently. The king may have thought that he was good. He was doing this good thing for other people. But the biblical writer is telling us that it was God working in the heart of the people. That's how the return from the exile took place. There was nothing exteriorly miraculous, you know, something out there that you could see, was quietly. And the people apparently didn't like it. The Israelites were not too happy with that. No, they wanted the Lord to come out and do something for them, so that the prophets were not able to solve this problem. The book of Chronicles is the last book written in the Old Testament, the last book written. Now in the Bible, in our Bibles, Malachi is the last one. But in the Hebrew scriptures, the last book written was the book of Chronicles. And the purpose of that book is precisely to remind the people of God that there was a reason for what took place and that the Lord is still with them. Now, this is the context in which the book of Esther is or was written. A time when the people were not sure the Lord was with them. They were not sure the Lord was with them. Their faith was almost gone. They were still following the exteriors of the faith, but they really doubted whether the Lord was with or not. So God inspired this man. I suppose it was Mardukai. I told you that I'm not sure, but I suspect that it was Mardukai who wrote the book. He inspired this man to write this book at a time when there was not a prophet, apparently, as far as we know, interpreting for the people of Israel the historical events, what was happening, telling them this is happening for this and for that. There was no prophet. So the Lord raised this man to take this incident that took place in Persia and to write the story the way it is written for us. He used a very peculiar way to write the story. He decided to approach the story from a peculiar way. I'm going to leave God out of the picture. I'm going to leave religious language out of the picture. And I'm going to present the story. But I'm going to bring God in some other way. Why was he doing that? You see, what he did, in my opinion, is he took the experience of the people in the exile, the experience they were going through, and he incorporated it in the story. Are you with me? In the story, he's mimicking, we say that in English, to mimic, mimicking the condition of the people out there. They don't hear the Lord. There is silence out there. The king of Persia is the most powerful person that they know. They don't see the Lord anywhere. He's silent, he's invisible, and the biblical writer says, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to write this story in the context of their own experience. They don't see God. They don't see anything that is religious in history. That's what I'm going to do. Because these people have been hearing prophets using religious language and it has done nothing to them. So what they need is not religious language. They need to be brought back to the Lord going down to where they are. And he went there and he presented this story as if God was absent. But what was his intention, his real intention? To show the opposite. See, this is a topic that is, remember, reversals. You have an action that seems to, that is going to produce this reaction, but it doesn't. It produces the opposite. You know what I mean? Haman built the gallows, and that was going to produce something. That was going to be the place where Mordecai was going to be hanged. Well, it produced the opposite. So, using non-religious language would lead anybody to think that this book has nothing to do with religion, but it produces the opposite effect. It shows that silence very often is the dwelling place of God, is where he stands when he speaks to us. This is what he was doing. And therefore, those who later read the book, they were in the exile, they were able to see themselves there. Yes, this is how I feel, you know. I feel like Mardukai there, that nobody's with me. I feel alone here. Let me see what would happen. What is the resolution of this problem? Because it may well be the way my own problem is going to be solved. And through the story, he's trying to build up faith. You perceive the world in terms of cause and reactions. Cause and reactions. You know, somebody does something and this is a result. I want you to know that that's not the case, but I'm going to tell you the story as if it were the case. Are we together? This seems to be the case, but it's not the case. And then the story achieves that purpose at the end. You know, as you read the story, you're yet unsure, but at the end, you look back at the story, and then you see the hand of the Lord everywhere. And the best evidence that the biblical writer is giving to demonstrate that although God is silent, he's still present. The best evidence that he gives in the book is this. The people of God is still here. Now we live, he said to the readers, we live in a very difficult world of oppression, a world in which the people of God is being threatened from every angle constantly, he says, yet we have survived. And it is not out of our own skills and abilities. There is a hand working throughout history. The divine will has been woven. You say that in English? Woven. It's been woven within history, being developed. So, do not despair. Relax. Trust in the Lord. He is with us. You see the purpose of the book? I think the book was quite effective. I believe it was quite effective. Judaism survived the crisis. It survived the crisis. And that's why we have a Bible.
Why would that technique of writing be acceptable today? For people how they're interested in excitement and novels and whatever. Why could we interject that technique today?
Yeah, this is really about a secular society, you know. In our modern languages, the Israelites were secularized. Oh, yes. And the question he's asking is why don't we write books like this one, you know, where you address important religious and theological topics, how do you say that in English? In a silent way, you know, silent. In order. Well, let me tell you this: the Adventist Review. If you check the Adventist Review, we have four, I think, a month. One of the issues is trying to address the non-religious, and that's why you find stories. Many stories of people who went through experiences and the Lord was with them. But the religious language is very open. Now, we're doing evangelism in some parts of the world, trying to reach the secular mind, in which we're trying to do this. we go to them and we talk to them in non-religious language, hoping to be able to bring in the Lord that way. I'm a little concerned about what sometimes is done, you know, because it's very easy in trying to reach the secular mind to secularize the church, you know. If the secular mind wants rock and roll, then we're going to have some rock and roll for them in order to reach them, hoping that later on we can, you know, these are issues, very difficult issues. But what you can immediately see the parallels with Esther, and the problem that they faced is really the problem that we are facing. You have a church that in many places and many church members are raising these questions. Lord, where are you? Now, this is happening to the church. Are you going to intervene or are you, where are you now? And in our own lives, we go through very difficult situations and we raise the question, Lord, where are you? But if we look carefully at our lives and how the Lord has led us, you're going to be impressed. All you have to do is think back when you were a child. Look, you know, think for a minute, you know, the town where you were born and the neighborhood where you grew up and the friends at the school and see what the good Lord has done to you. And almost in mysterious ways, using people that you would have never thought he would use. Saying a word, opening a door for you. Sometimes people who do not even believe in him. And the book of Esther is saying, look at that. No? You don't hear his voice, but he is right there within the human arena, working with you and leading you. And what he wants you to do is what Mordecai and Esther did. Work with him. Allow yourself to be an instrument of his providence. And reach others, touch others. Work for the benefit of others. Well, I have more to say. I think I saw a hand somewhere, but I don't remember. Oh, yes.
I was just going to say one comment is that the question is there. Why don't we do this? Two things. One, as you mentioned earlier in the week, that many Jewish still look at Esther and say, you know, there's no mention of God. You know, is this the first story? I don't know how many centuries later, there's still criticism for his method of doing this. And, you know, and second, you know, there are a lot of people who are trying to, in our world, trying to be Christian without being overt. And there's room for both camps. But oftentimes, those who are overt criticize those who are not overt. They say, you should mention it. You should mention God at every occasion. And there, I think there's room for both sides. The other thing I've read is that, and I don't know, it seems to be true that I read once where that in all the great novels, the best parts are usually scriptural allusions. You know, in some of the great books,
yes.
The most meaningful thing is really, you can find in the scripture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not that, you know, there's a lot of bad novels, there's a lot of bad stuff out there, but some of the best stuff is.
Yeah, it has some influence from the Bible has influenced some of them. Yes, it's wisdom what we need. We have to ask the Lord every day to help us to represent him properly. You know? You have the experience of Mordecai trying to represent him. He got into trouble and yet he was trying to avoid trouble. We have to learn when to talk, when not to talk, what to say to people, what not to say. People are not interested in religion. If you say anything about religion, they close the door. Impossible to reach them, you know. But you have to find ways to reach them. I remember being in a physician's office, and there was a husband and a wife waiting there. The doctor was not in. He had to go to the hospital, so we had to wait quite a bit. And I noticed that they were breathing hard. But it was not because they have difficulties breathing. Their eyes showed that they were going through some stress. So I said to them, you seem to be going through a very difficult emotional problem. And they say, oh yes, we are, you know, we're both sick, and my son had a problem, and they told me about the son, and I said to them, have you thought about getting some psychological help? You see what I did? I was ready to tell them, you know, talk to the Lord. But I wasn't sure whether these people were religious or not. So have you thought about getting some psychological help? And they thought, no, we haven't thought about that. We really don't know what to do. Do you know any psychologist? And I said to them, I do. I have done some counseling, I said to them. And I'll be glad to, of course, pastoral counseling, you know. And they said to me, well, if you could give us some time, I will be happy to sit with you and talk about this. And we began to talk there about the situation. The three of us were the only three there. And it was interesting listening to them. And in the middle of the conversation, they said to me, you are a minister, don't you? And I said, yes, I am a minister. And perhaps I can help you not only with the psychological stress, but perhaps we can pray together. And I say, yes, sure, yes, yes. Are you religious? He said, well, you know, we don't go to church, to any church. My parents were from some, but our parents, but we don't. But you see, the moment came when they were ready for that. Wisdom, asking the Lord wisdom to know what to say, when not to say, when to say it, when not to say it, you know, being sensitive. This is our task in this world. You know, we're not here to walk through this planet working and eating and sleeping. We are here to do a job, and we have to look for opportunities. God's silence is intense. You know, people don't hear him, and people want to hear him. Secularism is here because people lost faith in God. So the people are hurting, and we have to find ways to reach them. And sometimes the approach of Esther is the one. And in the case of the Israelites, it worked very, very well. And many other things about the book of Esther that I can tell you. Now, since we know that God is in the book of Esther, it would be nice to study this character who is there, but you can hear it. Him, who is there, but is silent. So, well, you know, this is, in the book of Esther, how is he depicted? No religious language is used, so how do you go about identifying and describing who is God in the story of Esther, you know? This is for me, this for you it isn't, but for me it's fascinating. That's right, and we need that. You see, what we're seeing is, we see a little of this even among ourselves, we want to hear the supernatural. And people are looking for that, in religion in general. You have this people, there is a tremendous thirst for the supernatural, you know. Because people want to hear something from the other side. And Esther is saying, don't do that. He's here with you. No? And here is this story to tell you, to show you that this is the case. He's here. All you have to do is open your eyes, pay attention to his providential guidance, and you will be immediately persuaded that he, in his silence, is speaking to us. Now, there are several things in closing that I want to say about the book and Ellen G. White. She takes this book and she interprets it as a type of what is going to take place at the end. It's very impressive. She doesn't write much about it, but almost always, whenever she addresses the book of Esther, it's in terms of this is a type of what is coming. And she draws parallels. You can read about that in page for some prophets. I'm sorry, prophets and kings. There's a whole chapter on Esther where she develops this idea. And she takes the attempt to exterminate God's people in Esther, and he says this is what is going to happen at the end. There's going to be an attempt to destroy God's people. The silence of God in Esther. Now, you have to, if you're going to look for this, you have to read carefully, otherwise you won't find it. The silence of Esther, it seems to me that she takes the silence of God, I'm sorry, the silence of God in Esther to represent the withdrawal of the Spirit from the world. The increase of wickedness and evilness. Because really what accentuates God's silence is the increase of sin and evilness. That's what makes it difficult to hear. You know? And she says at the end there is going to be, the Spirit is going to withdraw. And people are not going to listen to the voice of God. But she also indicates that the conflict is not only going to be a horizontal conflict. It's going to be also a vertical conflict based on Esther. She says, you know, what you have in Esther is the union of religion and state. And there is therefore this vertical dimension where there is a contact with supernatural powers, and then there is an attack horizontally against the people of God. And he takes that to be the increase of spiritualism in the last days. Now, I don't know whether you are aware of what's happening in the spiritual world these days. Spiritualism is, it's everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. I received a telephone call probably a month and a half ago from a lady, church elder in one of our churches in North America. And she called and she said to me, "I'm a little confused. Please help me." We invited a couple of physicians to come to our church to give us a seminar on health. And it was very good until the last day. They brought one of this bed, you know, and they placed a person who was sick on it. And then they began to move their hands. Because they believe that the body produces this bodiless energy. and by feeling these bodily agencies, the flow, they could determine which internal organ is sick. And they were doing that right there. And I said to myself, this is a lady talking to me. I said to myself, what is this? And I'm calling, I want to know what is that. Well, I don't know. You know, I know about this. I don't. There's a terminology for that. I can't remember it now. I'm sorry? And it comes from the Eastern religions. Whether I said to her, whether this was spiritualism or not, I don't know. But it's very close to it. Too close for me. You know what I mean? And she said, Elder, thank you very much. I was traveling from Switzerland to Germany the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. I got to the airplane and I said, I always ask for an aisle seat in case of a fire. And I'm reading. There's somebody in the window there. The middle seat is empty. So, you know, you have to wait a few minutes. So I opened my book and I'm reading. And at the very last moment, a young man came in. He was probably, I would say, between 23 and 27 years old. A tall fellow, well-built, handsome. And he came with a big smile. He smiled, and I, you know, allowed him to sit down, and he sat there, placed things in their place, and then he sat there, and he sat, and as soon as he sat, he did this. You know, I do that too. I'm tired, I, you know, cross my arms. It's easier for me to sleep with my arms crossed than if they are hanging. So I thought, this fellow is going to sleep, so I'm not going to disturb him. And the airplane left, and all throughout the flight, he was there. But there was a moment when I realized that there was something strange going on. Because of his, the way he was breathing. I said, there's something wrong here. This man is really going through some kind of transcendental meditation. He's not really sleeping. I said to myself, and I prayed. Hey, I prayed. I don't know what I'm going to face, so I prayed. You know, he's too close to me. I said to the Lord, Lord, send me, hey, if need be, send me Gabriel. You know? It's good. Any angel is good, but if the situation becomes too difficult, send me Gabriel. And I'm, you know, and the airplane landed, and as soon as it landed, he came back to life. And I looked at him, and I received from him the most beautiful smile on a face of peace. I mean, he really looked that. I was impressed. There was so much peace there. And a beautiful smile. And he looked at me and he said to me, I was shown that you have a good life. And I looked at his eyes and I said to him, you were shown wrong. My life is not a good life, it's the best life there is. And I would like you to join me. And the smile, the peace was gone, and he looked at me very seriously. And I said to him, you know, there was no time, the plane was already there. I had seconds. I said to him, I want your name. Give me your name. I said, that's not necessary. Now we're standing, you know. It's not necessary. Please give me your name. Not necessary. Why do you want my name? I'm going to pray for you. Not necessary. So, you know, people are walking out and he walks quickly in front of me and I went after him. You see, this is the only time I was going to see this man. I was sure, you know, never again I'm going to see him. Never again. So as we're walking out, I pull out one of my business cards with me, that I had with me. And when we got inside the terminal, I walked very fast and tapped him on the shoulder. And he turned around. And I said to him, your spiritual guide is deceiving you. He comes to you as if he were light, but he's darkness. Man, was he really mad. And I said to him, take this. There is my telephone number is there. There may come the time when you may want to get rid of your spiritual guide. Call me. And I know how you can get rid of my telephone. We get rid of it, take it. And he moved back. He said, no, I don't want it. And I stood there looking at this man and praying and saying, Lord, take him to somebody else who can help me. Him. This is Europe, you know. This is not somewhere in South America. This is Europe. This is a European fellow. Well educated. Spiritualism is every. I can tell you a couple of other stories in airplanes with spiritualists. It's impressive. It's everywhere. The most impressive was a lady who was an astrologist. And she sat by me. And as soon as she sat, she looked at me like this and she said, what is your sign? I said, sign? Yeah, I'm not thinking about signs. See, your sign. My sign, what do you mean? Astrological sign. Oh, I'm not sure what is my sign. When were you born? May 6th. Oh, you're Taurus. Oh, but you don't look like Taurus. And then she looked at me for a few seconds at the eyes, and I'm looking at her, you know. I'm already praying. And I'm not afraid of these people, you know. So she looked at me and she said, I cannot get inside your mind. And I said, why? There's a cloud. There's a cloud there. And I said, well, do you know what that cloud is? She said, no, I have no idea. That's the presence of the Lord. He comes into a cloud to our minds. You will never be able to penetrate that light. And she looked at me and she said, you're a minister. I said, yes, I am a minister. She said, are you a Seventh-day Adventist minister? I said, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist minister. This is unbelievable. You know, I don't tell these stories very often because people don't believe them. That was not the end. At that time, I was the president of Antillian College. And this lady visited Antillian College about 8 or 10 years ago before that meeting with me in the airplane. Just visited. She couldn't believe that I was a Seventh-day Adventist minister. She said, this is I can't understand this, she said. No, this week I was driving. I had a flat tire. I got out of the car, didn't know what to do. A car stopped. Believe it or not, an Adventist minister stopped to help me. And I said to her, you think that was a chance? And it happened by chance? She said, well, apparently. She said, no. Wait, you're an astrologist. You believe that the cosmic forces coordinate everything. So perhaps somebody is coordinating these meetings with Adventist minister for you because you have to listen to an important message. And she smiled and began to think for a while. We talked for over 2 hours. And she told me stories that were very difficult to believe. How she hurts, she says. I hurt. I'm really hurting all the time because I see people, friends of mine, and I see what is going to happen to them. And this thing is really destroying me. And I said to her, you want to get rid of it? Do you want to get rid of it? And she sat there with her head down thinking and thinking and thinking. And she said, I'm not sure. And I said to her, take my card. And she took it. Doesn't matter when, you just call. I may not be there, but they will know where to find me. 10 years from now, just call that number and ask them to tell you where I am. And they will be able to find me and tell you where I am. And I can tell you that with God's help, your friend will be gone. She didn't say a word. Sat there, and then she went her way, went my way. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's in the magazines, on TV, on movies, cartoons, everywhere. This thing is taking the world over. Yes. And for Ellen G. White, that's what you have there. This act of Haman consulting his gods was a contact with the demonic spiritual powers. And those spiritual powers in Esther seem, they appear to be controlling historical events. They appear to. But at the end, that's not the case. And Ellen G. White also takes the decree and applies it to the decree that we have in the book of Revelation chapter 16. And then you have in the book of Esther the conversion of the Gentiles. You remember? In our eschatology, what would that be? A loud cry. We're going to have many people leaving the church, but you are going to have as many, more than coming into the church and joining the people of God. And finally, you have deliverance. We're going to be like Mordecai. We're going to be creating problems for others, and they're going to try to get rid of us. On the Sabbath, she also associates the Sabbath with Mordecai. And then comes deliverance through the power of God and rejoicing. This feast of Purim that you have at the end of the book is a symbol of the Feast of Tabernacles that we're going to celebrate, so to speak. We're going to celebrate in heaven after the second coming. And if you read the book ends with an important note. Joy. Joy. Man. Joy. Read Isaiah 35. You want to read about the new earth, the new world, and the experience of joy? Read Isaiah 35. Joy is what is going to define human nature throughout eternity. Instead of a sinful nature, what we're going to have is joy. Whatever that is. Because the joy we know is weak. And it's easily pushed out by sadness. But the book of Esther tells us that evil is defeatable. And that we are heading toward the greatest reversal in human history that humans will ever see. A reversal from sin to perfection. The second coming of Christ. It's been wonderful being with you here. I have enjoyed every minute more than you. And I wish you the very best. Thank you for coming. And I hope that you will find some good out of our discussions here.
This special presentation has been brought to you by American Cassette Ministries. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2001, American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. For additional cassettes by this speaker or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please contact us as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 1-800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 1-717-652-9050. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. Our entire current catalog plus many other items are available online from our secure website, www.americancassette.org. We accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover cards. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania 17108 in the United States of America. Answering the heart cry of the faithful for 26 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry, to prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.